You are tuning in to Agenda Awani with me, Cynthia Ng. In this episode today, we'll be taking a closer look at the escalating tension between China and the US and its impact on the region. Joining me on the show is Ernest Bauer. He is the president and CEO of Bauer Group Asia. Thank you so much, Ernie, for making time to come to Astro Awani. Long way for you from the US, so thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Ernie, I think the past few weeks have been pretty intense in terms of global events. We've seen war game exercises, the US sailing through the South China Sea, and then China encircling Taiwan in response to that. I just want to get your take on this. A lot to take in, but what do you make of it? And do you think there's a risk of escalation?
There is a risk of escalation, always. But these are pretty normal activities. Mm-hmm. I think in the context of the current US-China tension, I think there's a lot of attention to things that usually happen. The Americans typically sail through. It's called FON Ops. And the Chinese reaction was a little extreme. But I think it's something we all have to be watching closely. I think companies are now doing war games themselves to understand what they would do in the case of a conflict in Taiwan. We're seeing, you know, really heightened anxieties around Southeast Asia about the U.S. and China sort of hopefully not bumping into each other.
Well, they're not bumping into each other yet, but they're certainly butting heads in terms of not just military, but trade, technology. Sure. I think for ASEAN countries, it's a rather tricky situation to navigate. A common refrain that we hear is, you know, don't make us choose. You know, we do not want to choose. So do you think that ASEAN as a region, with a lot happening at our backyard, do you think that ASEAN can still stay neutral, or will they eventually have to pick a side?
I think ASEAN by nature is neutral. It wants to be neutral. I think it's ASEAN is the middle of the architecture for that's been built in Asia for trade, for security, I think both the United States and China have an interest in ASEAN remaining neutral. I know the Americans don't want to make ASEAN choose. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think the Chinese do see Asia as their sort of area of dominance. Mm-hmm. So I think there is going to be some bumping and some competition. And ASEAN will feel it, but you're right, ASEAN doesn't want to choose, and hopefully it won't have to.
Mm. I think one interesting angle that's coming out of this is that whether China's growing influence in the region means the U.S. is losing out. Is the Indo-Pacific region just a zero-sum game where one country will come up on top, or is it that really that simple? What's
no,
at play here?
No, it's not that way at all, I think. I think a more sophisticated way to think about it is China's rising. It's becoming a bigger player. I think the real question is what China wants.
Yeah.
As we've seen since World War II, you know, the Americans don't want to sort of run Southeast Asia or dominate Southeast Asia or Asia itself. But they have been a security presence, and I think a relatively benign one. And the question, I think it's a natural question. Everyone's asking is, you know, what does China want? What does it want to be? And I think their actions in the South China Sea have raised anxieties among Southeast Asian countries and quite frankly, globally. How far does China want to go? What does it want to do? I think we'll see a leveling out. Mm-hmm. Of that at some point, I hope without conflict.
Okay, now let's talk about the U.S. It is clear that U.S. has been re-engaging Southeast Asia, Indo-Pacific for economic and geostrategic reasons. But how will smaller Southeast Asian nations benefit from this? And can you help us understand Biden's strategy and where the Southeast Asia fit in there?
Yeah. American investment in Southeast Asia is 10 times larger than it is in China, for instance. And it's larger than all U.S. investment in China, Japan, and India combined. Mm-hmm. So the American engagement, economic engagement in Asia is deep. It's long. It's been over many years. It's not going anywhere. That investment is embedded. So I think that's pretty safe. I don't think that's a zero-sum game. China, we need China to be engaged in Southeast Asia and doing well economically. I think what the Americans and I think most Southeast Asian nations, even no matter what they say publicly, privately will tell you, they just don't want China to try to make the rules and control standards and what's happening in the region. Nobody wants anybody to control that. And I think in the end, Southeast Asia will be the place where China and the United States meet and compete. Mm-hmm. But I'm hopeful that because of economic prosperity and the upside of cooperation versus the downside of conflict, that we'll have a positive outcome.
There's been so much talk about competition between these two powers. I wonder, do you see any areas of cooperation or things that they could complement each other?
Yeah, I think there's deep cooperation in business. The United States and China work closely together. American companies have invested deeply in China. And even despite all the headlines, they're not leaving China.
Okay.
They might be investing in sort of China plus one or plus two or plus three. And that's actually good for Southeast Asia. The Chinese also are working in the United States. So economic cooperation between the United States and China at the private sector level is deep. I think the areas where we're having conflict is in some of the higher tech sectors, mm-hmm. like semiconductors and other areas. And unfortunately, over the last decade, the Chinese have really drawn down a lot of goodwill with American companies because of how they've treated them in China. So even though it's tough doing business in China, we're still there, and I think we'll continue to grow our presence.
What is the conversation among business leaders? You're a keen observer when it comes to business politics in both regions.
Yeah.
What are they saying? What are these CEOs or managers, what are they telling you?
I think they're worried. They're worried about geopolitical risk. This is the U.S.-China mm-hmm. conflict and the potential for... no company can move forward without thinking about what would happen if there's a conflict in Taiwan or in the South China Sea. You know, what would that mean to supply chains? What would it mean for their people and markets? And companies are really considering that. So they're also, because of the tension between the two countries, they're de-risking China, which means that they're investing in other places if the U.S.-China relationship...
One.
Yeah, the plus one, but plus many, actually. Mm-hmm. They will still be able to prosper in Asia if they get their access to the China market cut off. And I think Chinese companies are also planning that. And that's also been good for Malaysia mm-hmm. and Southeast Asia because a lot of the Chinese private companies have been moving down here and building sort of a local presence, trying to be more Southeast Asian than PRC Chinese, which is actually a pretty smart move.
Okay, I want to get to that a bit later on in the show. I do want to bring up, since we're talking geopolitics, U.S.-China,
yeah.
I think one thing that's worth discussing is Biden's launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity, or IPEF, in short last year. He launched it in May. Can you elaborate the importance of IPEF and how it fits into the broader U.S. strategy for the region?
Yeah. The Biden Asia team is probably, if I had to pick sort of an all-star team of American experts and officials who know China, who know Asia and are highly capable, a lot of those people are on Biden's team. So it's a very good team. They know Asia fairly well. And IPEF is their response to how do you keep economic engagement by the Americans in Asia without being able to have the support of Congress.
Mm.
So politically, there's no chance, I think, in the near term for the Americans to be able to negotiate a new trade agreement or commitments on trade and economics that require the passage of laws or the approval of Congress. And that's because, unfortunately, in the United States, trade and Asia politically have become a, sort of a bad word because of the rising conflict with China. And it's an oversimplification, but it's the state in which we're in right now.
And there's, of course, concern about the longevity of IPEF, taking into account the presidential elections next year. We know that during Trump's time, there was a disengagement toward this region. And how would the U.S. convince IPEF and its partners in that sense?
Yeah, I actually think I'm concerned about it. Mm-hmm. IPEF is a policy. It's not a law. It has no... it's the Biden administration's approach. So to be fair, Asian countries that are worried about the longevity of IPEF, should there be say the Republicans win in 2024 in the United States, and depending on who's president, they could easily say, we're not going to do IPEF. We're backing up. We'll negotiate something else. I think that would be deeply, deeply troubling for Asian partners who've really reached out and to try to keep the Americans economically engaged. And I think there'd be very deep disappointment here. And that's disappointment building on the disappointment when the Americans, when Trump was elected, and his first act was to say that the Americans would not be involved in CPTPP.
I think at this point in time, Biden is still pushing aggressively for IPEF. I think the last talks he had was in Bali in March. But so far, there haven't been many details or substance shared about the initiative. Would you happen to be able to share with us about the timeline or scope and as well as exclusivity of IPEF?
IPEF covers several sectors. I think probably one of the highlights is digital. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably got the most likelihood of success, where countries in IPEF are negotiating and they can agree or disagree. So you don't have to make a commitment to
IPEF. It's an opt-in structure.
It's an opt-in structure. I think the...
But that's one of the criticism as well, because it's an opt-in structure.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you, it's a very weak substitute for substantive trade agreements like the TPP or RCEP, which is designed for Asia. But I think the rest of Asia knows it's the best the Americans can do right now. Mm-hmm. And the Americans know that they've got to stay engaged economically at a policy level with Asia, because that is the foundation of a strong security presence.
Now, you mentioned that it's weak compared to the CPTPP and the RCEP, of course. Particularly CPTPP gives much more access in terms of trading space beyond Asia.
Yes.
We're talking about places like Canada, Chile, Mexico. How do you think that this IPEF will move forward in the future, and how do you strengthen it?
Honestly, I think IPEF is sort of a precursor. It's a holding place for the Americans to eventually enter into CPTPP.
Okay.
So at some point, the U.S. private sector and more rational minds in Washington are going to do the calculus correctly and understand that economic engagement in Asia is vital for American national security. I don't know when that will happen, but that would be the most successful outcome for IPEF. In the meantime, best case scenario, we agree, we all opt in on areas where we can cooperate. I think digital engagement is probably the highest likelihood for engagement and opt in by the most countries. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
One of the interesting points that we're maybe talk about IPEF, is, of course, there's this comparison with the other trade deals and how it offers maybe less economically to countries. I know you mentioned opt-in structure and then you have certain pillars, but how do you convince the partners to come in? And India already has said, I'm going to opt out trade. So what is that argument you have then, you know, to convince players to be part of it?
I think it's a great question. I mean, the Americans want to talk about things like labor rules and environmental standards. But you really, to do that, those things in Asia, it's just much more transactional. Mm-hmm. You've got to offer market access, sustained market access. And that's, I think that's the carrot that America needs to offer. It's the carrot that America can't offer without approval of Congress. So it's not included in IPEF. And that's the weakness, I think, of the approach. But again, I think the value of IPEF is it's a political commitment and a statement of American commitment to economic engagement in Asia, and it's the best that the current government in the United States can do.
Okay, well, thanks for your insights on that. I'd like to shift our focus to Malaysia specifically.
Okay.
It's interesting to consider the country under the new administration under Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim. Do you like what you're seeing so far in terms of our investment policies and also engagement with our partners?
Yeah. First of all, I really like Malaysia. I've spent over 30 years, working on trade and investment between the United States and Malaysia and with ASEAN. I think I'm a real optimist about Malaysia generally. But the truth is that Prime Minister Anwar is pretty new. He's inherited an economic system that is very siloed in ministries. And I think having talked with him and some of his economic cabinet members while I've been here over the past week, I think he does have intention to try to streamline decision making, look for more coordination between ministries, and drive some strategic sectors forward, such as semiconductors, data centers, some clean energy, healthcare. These are really good ideas. I think in the near term, my estimation is, or understanding is, that he's got to watch after the domestic political store until elections, the upcoming state elections happen. And then he can sort of deepen his focus on the advancing the economic competitiveness of the country.
Okay, now speaking of economic competitiveness, what do you think are some of the quick wins that Malaysia can focus on in the near term?
Sorry, I didn't hear the...
Okay, what are some of the... We're speaking about economic competitiveness.
Yeah.
What do you think are areas that Malaysia can focus on in the near term as quick wins?
Quick wins. I think a clear quick win is education.
Mm-hmm.
Malaysia needs more trained talent. There are really good schools here. Minor changes to the immigration rules and allowing foreign students to, for instance, stay for a couple of years after they finish their degrees here, rather than leaving immediately after they finish their degrees and you have that giant brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real loss. I think, so on education, there's a quick win there. The other one is semiconductors. Malaysia's semiconductors contribute over 7% of Malaysia's GDP, and Malaysia right now is the premier place in the semiconductor supply chain for the back end or the packaging and assembly part of the semiconductor sector. So if Malaysia can focus on allowing more foreign talent who are highly trained, these are engineers, PhDs, master's degree students who have the technical capabilities to work in that sector and move Malaysia up into the next level of semiconductor fabs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great opportunity right now because the semiconductor companies are looking for places in the world that aren't China, and China's looking for partners because they're going to have to build their own architecture outside of the architecture that the United States is leading and the four-chip alliance. So there's competition, and Malaysia could win on both sides if it plays its cards right, but it has to tweak some of its policies to be able to do that well.
Now, speaking of competition, like you mentioned, our neighboring countries, so Vietnam, of course, is one. Indonesia really focused on getting in this foreign direct investment. But where do you think Malaysia has the appeal, or what could attract foreign investors to come here for long term?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's be honest. Malaysia has done very well in foreign investment over the years. Of late, it's fallen behind. Mm-hmm. I think it's fallen behind competitors who have focused on it. I think Malaysia has been focused on Malaysia and its domestic politics. And meanwhile, Vietnam is focused completely on building the economics and attracting foreign direct investment. It's also a one-party system. So when they make decisions, it's top-down.
Yep.
Here, hasn't been that level of focus. And I think Malaysia has been losing out a little bit, but over too many years. And I think if you lose out a little bit over too long a period of time, you find yourself pretty far behind. And I think that's my greatest fear about Malaysia's competitiveness. It's got to get back in the game. It's got to get back in the game soon.
Do you think Malaysia can bounce back from that?
Absolutely. I think Malaysia is very resilient. People want to be here because of where Malaysia is.
What do we have going for Malaysia?
Geographically, Malaysia is the bullseye of global competitiveness. It's where the Pacific and the Indian Oceans meet. It's where the growth is. It's in the middle of that. It's multicultural. In a place that's relatively safe from natural disasters. So geographically, climate-wise, it's stable. Get the government right and get governance right and get back to focusing on economic development as a priority. And Malaysia will, there's a lot of money that wants to come here. And it hasn't given up hope.
Well, certainly our new government are very, they've been saying that, okay, we are really open for business. And I'm not sure if you heard, Anwar recently came back from his China trip and pledged 170 billion ringgit in investments, pledge, the keyword here.
Yeah.
But I do want to get your thoughts, speaking to business leaders. Malaysia wants the investment, but are we sending the right message to them? What do they want to hear for them to feel confident enough to put their money in this country for a long period of time?
They do want to come. I thought the China trip was good for Malaysia. We all know that the Chinese MOUs rarely come through to the level that they're committed. But China is serious about Malaysia. It wants to invest here, and it is investing here. So that's good for the country. It's actually good for everybody who's doing business here, including American businesses. I think what Malaysia, the signals it should send is we're open for business. We're going to have continuity of policy. We will coordinate our economic policy between ministries. Right now, it's really hard for investors. They get sort of turned around to one ministry and then another ministry, and it's hard to get all these answers. And then you have to go to the state level and get approval for water or electricity or land. So it's unnecessarily complex in Malaysia right now. And it wouldn't take much to sort of get a more coordinated approach, and that would be very successful.
Well, just one final question, Ernie. What do you think would be some of the key challenges that our new administration will face in the near term? State elections aside, what are some of the key things that need to work on?
Yeah, I think confidence. I mean, I think you've got to convince Malaysians first and then the rest of the world that you're going to have a government that is going to govern Malaysia for several years and has the time to implement sort of an economic policy that has continuity. I know that Anwar and the members of his cabinet, I know they know what to do. Mm-hmm. The question is, can they do it? So the biggest challenge, I think, is Malaysia's bifurcated politics, the rise of an opposition that will challenge any policy that you put forward. They've got to have the confidence to implement those policies, and then they'll see a giant boost of jobs, prosperity, access to foreign markets. All these things will be really good for Malaysians, and I think it'll create a great boost for Anwar and his government.
All right. right. Well, thank you so much, Ernie, for sharing your thoughts. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.